Great. Welcome back. Okay, so we've just been talking in the break about the next hour because we've got so much stuff we want to show you. But before we get back into data binding, thank you all for all who've been sending through jokes to Rob. He's been chortling at my side.
There's some smashes here. Why are giraffes' heads so far away from their bodies? Because their necks are so long. These are people. Greetings from David Hasselhoff. Wish I'd taken computer science at Hull rather than Nottingham. Sounds much more fun. And where did Rob buy his glasses? Because they're cute. Well, they're police glasses, actually. I took them off a policeman. That's not quite true, but it's near enough. So with that, keep sending them through. I'm going to put all the jokes on my blog because, quite frankly, it needs it. That's robmiles.com. But now we've got to get back to the serious stuff and my man Andy and his data binding fun and games.
Indeed. Okay, so this is where Silverlight starts to get a bit more interesting. So we've done the basic stuff. We've put some controls on, events, and we've covered the styling side of things. So that's pretty good. And we've covered the input scope so you can influence what kind of SIP the system puts up. So that's all cool stuff. But now Damage Calc needs a bit of a rework, I'm afraid. It's kind of getting a bit messy. We need to sort it out. And to do that, we're going to do some nice data binding stuff. So I'm going to do two things in this section. First of all, we're going to look at an enhanced version of Damage Calc. And then, as I promised at the beginning of the last hour, we're going to dig deep into the list binding template, which is kind of interesting, the project template. So, yeah, like I said, at the moment we've got a bit too much unnecessary logic, if you like, in there to all these event handlers, and we're setting the control values a bit explicitly. But we can do this much neater with Silverlight using data binding. So data content in text boxes can, or actually any property of any control can be linked directly to properties in a data object. So we can set up this binding between, on the one hand, a data object, and on the other, some property of a control. And the syntax for that is something like this. So here we've got an example. This is taken from the list project template that we're going to look at in a bit more. So here we've got an example of a text blocks. Text blocks?
Text blocks,
Text
yes.
blocks. A text block, which has the name of content text. And then a text wrapping equals wrap, so it wraps around. And then we've got the style is static resource phone text title 3-style. All that you should be familiar with now. But the new stuff is now the text property, instead of being set to like 0 as an explicit and then something that the user can type into, what we've got is this binding statement in curly brackets, binding to something called line 3, which is some property of an object. Line 3 is a property of some data source. And then it's also got this mode attribute on it, which is set to one way. So there are three flavors of that. Now, that particular bit of XAML there doesn't actually say, okay, what is the object that we're binding to? So you define the data source by setting the data context property of any of the containing, well, you could set it on this one actually, but generally you set it on on the container object that this particular control is sitting inside.
So to take a step back, what's happening is that the control contains some text that the user's going to be typing in. What we want to happen is to have, when that text is changed, something change in one of our objects without us doing any work.
Yep.
So what this code here is saying is, okay, the text in this control is bound to a property in this object.
Yep.
And we don't have to care how it gets there. All we know is if the user changes this thing, we'll get something fired in our object to actually change that property. And the one-way, two-way business means we can flip it the other way. So in my program, I just change the property and the display updates as though by magic. So all the need for glue goes away because it's handled for us by the framework.
That's right. So we've got three values for the data binding mode. One time means the control property is set just once, and thereafter any changes to either the control or the data source are just ignored. One way means that the control object is kept synchronized with whatever value the data source object is set to. So you change the property on the line three the value on the line three property in your data object, and it will automatically update the display of the text property on your text block in this example. And then two-way works obviously both ways. So if you, in your logic, you change the value of the line three property in your data object, it will update the control. And if the user types a new value into that control, it will automatically update the data object. So this is how data binding works.
And it gets actually even better because you can bind other things in the text in objects to data bound properties too. You can bind their position. So you can move things around the screen just by setting a value X to another value, and the thing will slide about. So this has gaming implications as well. But we're going to use it so that when the user types a number in the text box in Damage Calc, our program just gets fired and told that number has changed, and we don't have to do any work to glue those two together.
Okay, now, there's a requirement for making all this magic happen. So your data source, so here we've got a class that's, again, ripped from the list project template, called ItemViewModel, this class, and that implements an interface called iNotifyPropertyChanged. And this interface, if you create a class and then you put colon iNotifyPropertyChange, in Visual Studio, you can then actually click and say, oh, implement it.
Make it for me, yep.
All it is this on line 13 there, all that interface is that basically it exposes a public event called called property changed, which is of type delegate property changed event handler. So it has to expose this public event property changed. And essentially, as you see there, on the bottom from lines 14 to 19, we've got a private method called notify property changed, which just is, this is kind of standard logic for how you fire an event from a class. So basically the logic on 16 just takes a copy of the current value of the property changed event, which essentially is only set to a value if you've got any subscribers, if somebody has subscribed to your property changed event. So that's what line 17 says. If that handler variable is not null, means we have got some subscribers, then we need to fire this event. And the way you do that is line 18. And then you just have to execute that logic basically every time the value of a property in your object changes. So here's the line 1. So you can see there in the setter, the getter, it doesn't matter, we're just getting the value of the line 1 field in the object. But the setter basically says, if the value that's been passed into this setter is different from the current value we've got on it, then obviously update it and then fire the notify property changed event.
If you're finding this a bit confusing, then don't worry. If you've ever wondered how a button works in a Windows form app, where it produces click events that you can connect to, this is pretty much the same thing. A button exposes a click event handler which you can bind to so that when it's clicked, stuff happens. We're making something has changed behavior, which we can bind to as well. So interested parties that want to be told when the number in our control changes can connect to that and get told when it happens. So don't worry about this. It's how Windows has been working ever since. It's just been made really useful by the way it's part of Silverlight.
Indeed. So let's have a look at what that means in terms of the actual code. So here we've got a new version of Damage Calc. And in this version, we've got a class, Damage class, which is our data object. Now, in actual fact, you will see often in Silverlight this term view model, and we could have renamed this the Damage View Model, if you like, because a view model is an object that can take part in data binding. Essentially means it implements iNotifyPropertyChanged. And so here we've got a damage class that implements that event, and the logic in here, here's a setter for the damage property. It's a float, and this logic here basically says if the value of being passed into this setter is different from what we already know it to be, update the internal value and then fire that event. And then also this last line of logic here resets the price because obviously you change the damage, it updates the price, you change the price, it updates the damage. So we've got a bit of business logic in here as well. So this is our data class, and then go back to our mainpage.xaml. Again, we've just got two fields, but now, this time, just going to show the XAML only. And here we've got our text box, and here we've got the binding. We're bound to the price property, and we've got two-way binding, and the other one is bound to the damage property and the two-way thing. And if you remember on the slides, I said, okay, the data context has to be set somewhere as well. So it has to know, Silverlight has to know, okay, where do I find this object that's got this damage and price properties? And that's a little bit higher up here. And here we've got the data context. And this is interesting. So data context is bound to another resource. another one of these resources. This is a similar technique when we were talking about the style. So we've got a resource is declared somewhere, and inside that resource dictionary with a key of damage class, we've got the data object.
So this is basically the link between the XAML, which describes the display, and the bit of code, the object, you actually want to have doing the business.
Yep.
And this is the point at which one thing is told about the other.
Yeah. And of course, you can get all this code as well. Now, where is that declared? Where is this resource dictionary? Well, in fact, it's this code just above here. So this is how you can declare a resource dictionary just in the page. So it's local to this page. And it's, if I just scroll up a little bit to the top, you'll see that this is, you see the top tag there. This is a phone application page, which is in the phone namespace, which is the Microsoft.phone.controls namespace in the Microsoft.phone.dll assembly. And here we're actually declaring the resources on this phone application page. And inside the resources, we've got a little resource dictionary with a single entry in it, which is of type local colon damage class. So I'm sure that some of you are going, well, okay, what's this local business? Well, this is another namespace declaration up here. So we've declared local to be the damage calc namespace. And damage calc, of course, is the namespace of this application. So what we're saying by this, all this XML here, is that this in the local assembly, there's an object called damage class, which is the one we were just looking at, of course, which is our view model that implements iNotify property changed. And inside the resource dictionary, actually, we've used the same name. We could have called that XXX, if you liked, and then down here, change this to XXX. That's just a key into the dictionary.
This is how you can build applications out of separate library components and tie them all together.
Yep.
And so you've got an awful lot of flexibility and power here. If it looks a bit scary and complicated, then just don't worry. Take the template we've got and add bits and massage to your satisfaction.
Indeed. Just to prove it all works. Incidentally, declaring this object in XAML, that's just one way of doing it. In XAML, you're declaring objects just in an XML kind of a way. We could easily have created an instance of damage class in our code, in the loaded event handler, and in the code you can actually set the data context property of the page to that object.
So let's say I've got a hundred. I've been allowed to spend £100. So put in £100 in damage and see what we get.
Oh, £100. You want to set the?
I
want to
do that one, yeah, because I'm a fussy customer.
Okay.
So click into damage. That's
all right.
That's it. Now £100.
All right.
Should be about $150. I'm hoping.
So do I hope as well. Oh, okay. A bit of a logic problem there, Rob.
Oh, okay. Sorry. Right. Fine. Version 4A.
Okay. Yeah.
That.
Recall. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Anyway, the principle is there.
Principle is there. Yes.
Even though, yes.
I'll get my coat.
Our testing has not been adequate on this one. Okay.
Right. So. Data binding. Again, you don't have to do it. You can do everything the hard way if you like. But this is a really nice way to tie applications together and make it very easy and the code simple and clear.
Indeed. Before we leave this subject, on lists, okay, so list boxes, for example, you can also obviously bind a list box. It will have a container for a number of list items. So it's a very flexible thing. It could have 0, 1, or many items in a list. So you can also obviously use data binding to bind to an object that is a collection, data object that is a collection of objects. And for that way thing to work, the list must be an observable collection type. And any item that is inside an observable collection, the individual items have to implement iNotify property changed, as we've said. So this structure where you've got an observable collection with iNotify property changed objects in it, this is all the plumbing you need to make data binding to lists work. So here's an example of an observable collection. This is taken from the list template, the new project template, which we're going to look at in just a moment, the main view model. And there you can see we've declared on line 11 there, the items property of this main view model class is an observable collection of type item view model. And in the constructor, we just actually plug some runtime data into there. Items equals new observable collection item view model. And then inside the brackets there, we're declaring two new item view model objects and setting a few properties on them. So this is setting up some test data. Now, there's an interesting thing, design time and runtime data. And actually, what I'm going to do, just see where we're up to in the decks. Yep. I'm just going to show you the project template that I've been talking about. I'm going to stop that one, create a new project. And this time I'm going to have a Windows Phone List application. Windows Phone List application 1. And before we look at the code, I'm just going to run it just to show you what it looks like. So here is our Windows Phone List application. Bring the emulator back to the foreground. Hang on, we're not sharing the desktop here. Rob, you didn't tell me that.
I was enthralled. I was gripped. I do apologise. And I've just shouted too, which will help everybody. Yes, you can now see it.
Okay, we're back on.
So we're back in there.
Yep. So here we've got a list. And a list of objects, and we can scroll up the list, and then we can hit any item. Is runtime 12? I'm going to tap on that, and it goes to the details page, runtime 12. We can go back, to our list.
So if you have like a main menu, and a bunch of things you want to make the user be able to do from that, this is a brilliant starting point.
It is.
So if you've got load, save, blah 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 blah, then you can basically map each of those behaviors to one of those things on the list, and everything's there for you.
Yep. Now, I don't know if you noticed, when it was running, the data was runtime 1, runtime 2, runtime 3, but here we actually got some data being displayed at the design time as well, design time experience. And this is all through clever use of data binding. So in this, let's just have a look at the XAML only on this guy. So inside our list box, we're binding to something called items, which is that observable collection. Items observable collection, and inside that, each individual data item is defined with this XAML here. And you can see that actually what you're seeing in the on the design. This is a beta feature that doesn't reload immediately. You can see that we've got each list item is defined by an icon. Then there's this design one, and then underneath that is another text box, and they're using different styles to display that. Go away. And the definition for that is each item in the list is defined by this data template here. And you can see that it's a stack panel of horizontal orientation. And on the left of this stack panel with horizontal, we've got our image, which was the little icon in the list. And then on the right of it, we've got another embedded stack panel, but this one is, there's no explicit orientation being set, and the default, if you remember, was vertical, which is why we're seeing two items, one above each other. First of all, this line one field is displayed as the first item in that embedded stack panel, and that uses the phone text extra large style. And then underneath that, we've got details text, which is bound to the line 2 field inside this, and it's a phone text subtle style.
There's a very important point here worth taking away, which is you can put things in containers inside containers to build a really rich user interfaces. You're probably used to doing that with forms, where you put things inside things, but with this, it's great. And you can see in the text where everything is, and add and twiddle.
Yep.
And you can just sit and, I do this, you can play with the XAML and watch the device itself changed to match that. So putting things inside things is the way you can build up these nice, lovely, rich things. And they all look after themselves.
Yep.
Because if you change the where they're placed, they'll just scale and arrange themselves to fit. It's a great way to put things out very quickly.
Now, the other thing I want to call out here is the actual where this data object. Now, if you remember in our damage calc, I had a local resource that declared an instance of the damage class, and that became our data source. A bit different in this one, and the beauty of this sample is you get this for free when you create a new list application. It's a working application, so I recommend you spend some time studying this. You'll see up here in the header we've got the data context, and I said that the data context property, which is what we use for defining what the object is that we're binding to, you can define that at any level of container, and here we're actually declaring it right up the top on the page. And we're setting the data context, but only at design time. We're setting it to something called design data. So this is an interesting feature of Silverlight. We're setting this to design data, which is in the sample data folder of our project and is bound to a main view model sample data.xaml file. So what is that? So here in Solution Explorer, here's our sample data folder, and there's our main view model sample data.xaml. This is defining our test data, and here's our design one test data. So you can see the definition of that is being done in using XAML, and we're defining, here's that local thing again, we're saying we've got a local namespace that's pointing at this application, which is Windows Phone List application 1. And what this XAML here is saying is, okay, I'm going to define in the items property of our main view model class, I'm going to create a bunch of item view models, and these classes are in here. So this is the equivalent of our damage class in damage calc. We've got a top level object, which is our observable collection. Okay, here is our observable collection, is the items property of this main view model class. So that's what the list binds to, and inside it we've got all these item view models, and the item view models of course implement iNotify property changed. So I hope you're getting a feel for how this all hangs together. And
I'm an XNA person. This is kind of new to me as well. But what it means, the way I understand it, is that means I can design with a thing which looks like the finished product. I can populate my design forms with what looks like real data, so I can get customer feedback on how that looks.
Yep.
And then when I press the button and do the build, that's tipped out, and we bind to the real data objects, which then provide us with the runtime behavior. So as far as we're concerned, we can make it look like a real one, we can talk it through with the customer, and then having done that, we can press the go button and whip in the real classes that do the work. That's a nice way.
Well, the design time data as well, yeah, because your UI engineer, who may be using Expression Blend, may be a brilliant graphic artist, but perhaps not so good on the coding side. And this is where the tools come in great for making the graphic artist has a tool set that they're comfortable with. And you can give them a whole set of design time data so that they can visualize using Blend. They can actually be creating your UI working with meaningful data. And then you, as the application developer, will plug in the real data at runtime.
So you could actually get the front-end design before you built the back-end.
Yep.
Fantastic.
Oh, yeah, and absolutely. And this is one of the real strengths of the Silverlight architecture. Just to round the circle, here's the code that actually sets the runtime data. So if data content is equal null, there's an event we're hooking here, we're overriding on navigated to, which fires when you navigate to this main page. If the data context is null, then we set it to app.viewModel, and I'll go away and go, and this is in our app class, let's go to the definition of that. And you can see that actually the data, the real data, the runtime data for this application, is actually defined in the app class, meaning it's global to the whole application. If you had a multi-page application, which is a topic we're going to come on to next, this data, your application data, is global to all those pages and is accessible through this app class, which is your kind of global variable storage, if you like, for your application.
Thank you.
Right. So let's go back. Back to the slides. Now the. Well, 1.3, there we go. Now then, so that was design time and runtime data. There was advanced data binding to a list. Actually, that was just walk through the template. Now, all this stuff, I hope you've got a taste for it. Now, what I really would advise you to do now is to go and reinforce the messages of the stuff that we've just talked through. If you go ahead and run through these labs, and it's got step-by-step instructions, and you've got starter code, and you've got the solutions, you can go through and build this lab yourself. There's a number of exercises in it and tasks. What we actually want to suggest that as a minimum that you do exercise 1, task 3, and 4. Clearly, you can do them all if you wish, but that's as a minimum you should try and go through those tasks, and that will reinforce the stuff that we've just been talking about.
And if you're wondering why it's called Lab 2 and you haven't seen Lab 1 yet, do remember that we actually jumped ahead to get to the coding. So if you go actually into the module we missed, which was 1.2, yep, then you'll find there's a lab reference there. And also on the site, we've actually got a little document with a crib sheet that basically lays out where the labs are and where to get them from for each of the sessions that we're doing. So there's no problem in terms of actually finding things. So is it review time now?
Should we go on, or do you think we need a bit of light relief?
Bit of light relief. Well, we've got these very quickly, so no need to vote until we get to. Let's just go through. So I can do this, can I? I can do this. Okay, yeah, so Silverlight's based on Silverlight 3, we know that one. You have to create your XAML using Notepad. I suspect not. Silverlight components cannot generate events. I would think we wouldn't
get very far without
that. Customize the keyboard display for text input. Absolutely, you can. So we're looking for Mr. Green on that one. And Silverlight components adapt to display settings automatically. You can make them do that. You can bind them to proper properties. We're in business there. And you can only read information from components using data binding. Let's see how good our audience is on this one. So people, what do you think? Is that true? Do you have to use data binding? Is it the only way to travel? It's probably the only way that Andy travels, but I can see a sea of red appearing as though by magic, because actually you can do it the hard way or the old way. It doesn't matter. As far as Silverlight's concerned, it's just there to make things better and easier. So data binding's nice, but yeah, red is appearing all over the place. Let's see if it's going to be red when we actually look at it. Yes, it is. So I'll pick a random red winner. Okay, it's right at the bottom of the list, and we'll get this gentleman here. Alvin Ashcraft.
Well done, Alvin.
Well done, Alvin. You won another prize. Can you pop onto the question thing? I'll make a note of your name on my list of winners. And that was comparatively painless. And so what we can do now is drop out of that session and move on to the next one.
Indeed. Now, we are running behind. So what we're going to do, and the good thing is we've got this fourth session as well, and there's a bunch of really important stuff we want to teach you. We're not going to get through it all in the half an hour that's remaining before we break for lunch. So what I'm going to do is we're going to do some of this. And we're going to actually move a bit of it onto Thursday.
We planned this, we actually left a lump of space free because we kind of knew this might happen. We didn't know which bits of content it would happen with. So we're going to keep to the overall plan. This afternoon we'll start with games. I'm doing the games. That will start in the second session. So be there for that, absolutely. Some of the Silverlight stuff we're going to cover now will be slid back to our final session.
Yep.
And so stick with it. We'll put some notes up on the website on our little home to make it clear exactly how that's going to fit together. So no worries, we'll sort it out. But for now, yep, bear with it. All friends here.
So the original plan for this was we're going to talk about how you navigate between pages on Windows Phone Silverlight and how you handle the hardware back key. I am going to do those. I think what we're going to do is the application bar, we'll move that onto Thursday. But then I'm going to just talk about how you create orientation-aware pages and how we handle the orientation on the phone, which is actually we're going to see something running on the real phone.
We have a lovely demo. Basically, yeah. Andy was up all night doing this as well.
That's not strictly true, but yes.
So he wants to show it off. The man needs his glory. He has a need for glory, as do we all.
Page navigation. So this is one of the key things that is interesting. So, first of all, let's just talk a little bit about what we've got. We have the Windows Phone Surface, which is obviously the background thing, and then the user experience that sits on top of that, with our applications on top of that. And then the Windows Phone runtime handles things like the SIP, and it's managing all of these components. And there you can see an application bar being shown. And your application sitting on top of things. And all of these components are being molded together by the runtime system tray at the top. You can see how it is. Now, this is the anatomy of a Silverlight phone page. So the frame is the top-level container control. Now, you've already seen these classes kind of being represented by the XAML that we've been looking at already. So we have the frame. Phone application frame class is the outer container. There's one of them for every app. And that contains the page control and also the system elements such as the system tray and the application bar. So the page is the bit that the main page.xaml that we've been working with, and in a minute we're going to create another one, which fills the entire content region of that frame and has a title and may have its own application bar. So page navigation is based, if you've done any desktop Silverlight application, I think in Silverlight 3, Visual Studio started coming up with these different templates for a navigation-based Silverlight app. And this was something that was a bit new, a new way of creating Silverlight apps. And essentially, it borrows a sort of a web browsing kind of model, the idea that you stick up a page and you hit a link and it will navigate through to another page. So we have a similar thing going on Windows Phone. So each page is identified by a URI, and you can see there the code snippet there. We have a thing called the navigation service, which has a navigate method on it, and you just give it a URI. So here we're navigating from main page to second page, and the URI is simply /secondpage.xaml.
So this is in the place of, if I'm a Windows Forms kind of guy, I'm using hide and show at this point, correct?
Yeah, or show dialogue.
This is actually a nicer way to do it, which fits. And if you're used to navigating by means of kind of web pages, this is sort of how that fits together.
And each page is essentially stateless, and by that I mean that once you move away, you've got your main page, and then you're navigating to the second page. So as you're leaving main page, your main page is blown away. It's not, you know, it's destroyed, and then your second page is instantiated, and once it gets deleted and you navigate back to the main page, it's blown away again. So they don't kind of retain a life. You don't set properties on them, and the next time you navigate to that page, it's automatically set or anything.
So it's your job to put those back to preserve the user appearance.
Yeah,
so
you need to save stuff in as we'll find in things like the state library or in isolated storage if you want to retain your data, which is a topic we're going to go into in some depth on Thursday. So to navigate back, you can actually put some UI on your second page to navigate back, if that's appropriate. But this is application specific as to whether that's an appropriate thing to do. In fact, the example there, if you've got a big button that says navigate back to main page, is absolutely not the right thing to do. The reason being, because every Windows phone has a hardware back key. So generally, that kind of navigation, you would expect the user, and the user would expect to use the back key to actually get back to the main list.
The back key is really nice because it behaves in exactly the ways the user expects it to do. They can go all the way back from your app up to the start menu and back into previous programs they've been running, and it works incredibly well as a navigation mechanism.
Indeed. Yeah. Now, sometimes, just occasionally, before I talk about overriding the back key, let's just create the basic app, which I need to share the content. Mm-hmm. Engage brain. There we go.
You may wish to know we were in here at 6:30 this morning preparing for this.
not that it's evident from the performance.
No one would know from... keep sending the jokes in, please, as well. We need those to keep us going.
Straight Windows Phone, and we're going to call this the navigation sample. So create this new project. And just so that we are clear where we are, I'm going to put main page on this first one.
So you do this kind of thing if you have a situation where you do want to have more than one page in your app.
Yep.
And you want to move between them. So for damage calc, if I wanted to put a page in where the user could type in the currency conversion and the local sales tax, then this is the mechanism I'd use to do that.
Yep.
And we'd have an extra button or something which says, OK, go on to the settings and then come back again.
Indeed. And I'm going to add a new item to this, which is yet another page. And you see we get a landscape page or a portrait page. I'm going to create another portrait page and call that second page. I'm going to add that. And I'm going to change the name to second page.
So now we've got two different pages open in two different design surfaces, and you can flip between them using the dialog, the menu. I'm pointing at the screen.
Yes, well done, Rob.
That really helps, Rob. But as you can see, as Andy's showing you, can basically flip between these two design surfaces, and as you do that, the XAML behind each of them changes as well.
And I'm going to create a control in here. I'm actually going to do it directly into the XAML, a hyperlink button control, and the content is the content is what is actually displayed inside it, so we can have text. In fact, a hyperlink button could be an image.
You can
have,
yeah,
this is why it's content, not text. But I'm going to actually put to next page in there. And let's put a click event on that. Is equal to a new event handler. There we go, it's in the middle there. Navigate to main page. And then I'm going to navigate to the event handler. And in the code, we have this navigation service dot navigate. And that takes a URI, so create a new URI object. And the string, the path to this, where this thing is, just /secondpage. Dot XAML. And it's, you have to put a type on that, which is a URI kind dot absolute relative or relative or absolute. Well, it's a relative one, always in a Windows Phone or an relative or absolute. And that should actually do us, I think.
That wasn't very confident.
Yeah,
that should actually do
that
us.
That will do
that
us
will
in
work.
Terms of illustrating that's the navigation.
Cannot
service.
Possibly fail.
Well, I'm fed up with this white phone, Rob.
I'm
sorry,
we'll change it back.
Navigate to next page, and there's our second page. And of course, we can just hit the back button and go back. So, wow, hey?
So
only the best demos in this session. So there we go.
So you've now got a multi-page app in about that, and the amount of code we had to write was teeny tiny, and most of it was made for us on the back of the XAML that we actually typed in.
Yeah. Now, I'm actually going to, next slide, talk about when you want to override the, but what I'm going to do is actually just going to straight away go into the demo for that. So here we've got our second page. I'm going to stick some content on it. You can go away. And you can shrink over there. So here we go. Let's put a bit of content into here. So let's have a stack panel with some just random controls in it. In fact, it's automatically vertical. So let's put a text block in there. Text equals item one.
You're going to use the magic of block copy in a minute, aren't you?
I am.
Yes.
How do you see that one coming?
I could see that. Block copy is actually evil, but in this case we'll allow it. So you can just whack in a few lines.
And actually, yeah, I'm going to... What I want to do is get my stack panel and just put a margin on that as well. So we... margin equals... And I'm going to move it in from the left, 40 and 40 down... that'll do us 0, 0. So it's just offset it in there. I could make that bigger, but what I'm then going to put on the bottom of my stack panel is another hyper... Well, so what should I put in this? A hyperlink button. Hyperlink button, and the content in there would be... change something, because what I'm going to do is pop up a pop-up window, show you how I might do that. End click equals and we'll fill that in a minute. So it's underneath. What I'm going to do is also in this same thing, I'm going to put in on this overlaying on this, which is one of the interesting things that we haven't shown yet about XAML. I'm going to put another stack panel. Even spell it right. Again, orientation is equal to vertical. I'm going to have this overlaying the thing. Margin equals 40 on all sides this time. And inside this stack panel, I'm going to put a list box. And inside that, we've got list box items. IntelliSense helping us there. Content equals item one, end. And And you see that's actually overlaying the other stuff, but what becomes interesting on this...
So we've now got two things on the same piece of screen real estate.
Yeah.
Okay.
Indeed. So it looks awful. This is, you've seen my my skills here. Terrible. Aquamarine, how about that?
I like that.
Yep, so ooh, it's overlaying that, but okay, we'll set the foreground to black as well. Go on. Oh, whatever. I'll do for the purposes of this. So, what we've got here is a truly crummy UI, but the visibility of this, I'm going to set this to be invisible.
So that will basically mean it won't be there on the stack panel.
Visibility is collapsed, indeed. And then when we go to the hyperlink button, we're going to set... Oh, I didn't give it a name, did I? X name is equal to pop-up.
So the scenario here is they've pressed something on the screen, and what we want to have is like a little area on the screen to appear for them to interact with. So for example...
Visibility is equal to... No, it's actually an enum, should be. Visibility equals, there we go, visibility dot visible. So, so run this, and our app comes up, get the emulator to the front, navigate to the next page, and at the moment, this is the thing without that pop-up panel on it, so we can just hit the change something, and then you get your pop-up thing, and there's our pop-up is overlaying the other content. But now, you see, your user would expect, if they hit the back key on this point, what would you expect, Rob?
I would expect the green thing to go away.
Indeed.
Because I want to see what's underneath. I'm giving up on what I was trying to do with my overlay bit.
Yeah, but what actually happens, of course, with the hardware button,
is it takes the whole page
goes,
page.
The whole page gone. So this is something, this is where you want to override how the back key works, which is very simple to do. So there we go to our second page.xaml.cs.
So from a design philosophy, you're getting like a little pop-up box in the middle. Yeah, okay, that makes sense to me.
This dot back key press, there's a back key press event on the page. We can hook that event. We'll set the allow the Visual Studio to do that. And in here, so now this is some code that's going to run when the user hits that back key. So we actually want to hide the pop-up again. Pop-up dot visibility is equal to visibility dot collapsed, which means it's invisible. And then we also have to tell the system that, because we've dealt with this back key, because otherwise it will ripple through the system and you won't have changed anything. So you have to select e dot cancel is equal to true. And now when we run it, we end up with, show the output. Here we go. Navigate to main page. Hit our change something. There's our list. User doesn't want to do that. Hits back, and we're still on the second page. So we've overridden the back key handler.
My guess is there's a layer of complication there, which is that if they hit the back key at this thing, they do want to go back. So we actually have to have a bit of code that says, is our little pop-up one visible or not?
You're so right, yes. Thank you for the flaw in my plan. So, yes. So there needs to be a bit of logic around.
You can test that by looking at the property.
Yeah, no. So you say if this...
If pop-up dot visibility equals...
Yeah, pop-up. If pop-up dot visibility is equal to... System.windows visibility dot visible. So we only want to do that logic if it's visible, yeah?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. Sorted that one out.
That's okay. He found a bug in my program earlier. So this is basically just...
So there we go. This is the correct way to do that. So that's the back key override side of things. All right. We're in good shape.
So from a UI point of view, you just have to look out for that Your users will complain pretty quick if they find the button doesn't do what they expect.
Yep.
The best kind of user interface, in my experience, is the one that gets no comments at all from the user. I just like it. It's just, oh, that's how it's supposed to work. And you spend ages making it do that, and they just don't understand. And that's why programmers are so unappreciated, one of the many reasons.
Yeah, nobody understands us.
Thank you.
So this is the stuff that I just showed you. So sorry about the formatting problem on that. We're passing data between pages. So the way you can pass data between pages, so like I said, they're stateless, but you do need to pass some context around. So one way you can do that is actually use a query string. So, but of course, that will only work with string data. So you can pass a string across, which could be, you know, stringified version of a key value in a list or of some kind. If you've got your data is stored in your app class, you know, it could be some key to an item you've selected from a list, some contextual information you want to pass over. But basically, you just pass that over in the query string so you can see how that is done. So at the top there, we've got an example where at line 3, in the query string, we're adding onto the URI a query string where MSG equals, and then we're pulling the value out of a text box 1, the text property out of that. So the result is that will end up on secondpage.xaml, and you can query the contents of that query string. And here we've got an example here in the onNavigated2 event handler, where you can go and say, if there is with the query string a tryGetValue method, if we find something there with a key of MSG, then we extract that value from the query string. So that's the way you can pass string data across between different.
If I'm in forms data land, basically I would do this by adding constructors to the child form I'm trying to hit, and then passing information that way.
But yes, there's a difference.
But this is much neater.
Well, it is, but the thing with the forms thing you just mentioned is that obviously you can pass any .NET object.
Yeah.
But that will only work, the query string will only work with string objects. So, but of course, often you do need to pass data objects around. So how do you do that? And the classic example, again, is if you study the template for the list project, that template gives you the one way of doing this straight off. So one solution, as is done by that project template, is to store your view model, that is your data, in your app class, which is global to the whole application. And then you simply pass the selected item index, which is the item index into your global view model observable collection, the particular item that your details page, as you see on that example, the design one is looking at the detail for the selected item out of the list. Then you're just passing sufficient information in that query string that allows the design page to go and pull the relevant data.
So you give
it
a key to say, go look in this box, and out comes information.
Thank you. Rob says it in a concise one sentence, but I took four or five to say.
I am that good, yes.
We just did all that. So now, this is the topic I'm going to slip over.
But it will be back.
Yeah,
it will be back. But you'll have to wait until Thursday to find out about the application bar. One thing I do know about it: you can't actually buy drinks at the application bar.
Thank you, Rob.
Sorry.
Right. So, kind of in this topic of navigation and pages and that sort of thing, it's time to talk about something that actually touches on the design things as well. We were talking about the thing, which is orientation-aware pages. So, a phone. We've got a phone, Rob.
I've got a phone. Here's a phone. Yeah, here's a phone. I'm holding it up to the camera now. There you go. Hello. Are we showing any video, guys?
Yes, we're on the video, yes.
Okay, yeah. I can't see it on there.
We're on the video. So on the video screen, you can see Rob holding the phone. And the phone, of course, tends to be used in portrait. But you can switch it around like that, and it gets used.
And these are the text messages that we've been getting through. Thank you very much for those. But as you can see, actually, there's a really neat thing which you probably can't see. Which is that the controls that actually control what happens, they spin around as well on some of the pages, which is really nice to see. But as you can see here, the phone's aware of this. Your application needs to either nail your application to be either portrait or landscape, or actually live with this behavior by changing the way the form looks when you change the orientation.
Yeah. Now, there's one very cute thing. Okay. Now, you saw before in Visual Studio, add new item, it gives you a list, a selection. You can say, oh, do you want a landscape page or do you want a portrait page? And I My personal view is that they shouldn't be asking that question, because any page can be either or both, and it's up to you. You can change it very, very easily. It's just we'll have a look in a minute. You can just change one property on the page, and that dictates what orientations it does in fact support. So a page can be portrait, or it can be landscape, or in fact it can be both, portrait or landscape. You specify that by setting the supported orientations property of that.
Okay.
And here's the key thing: if you have a page that is set to portrait or landscape, the page, when the user switches the phone round, it will automatically reorientate
itself. So we could make damage calc actually just work either way up, and the user would never know.
It would never know. So they happen to twist, rotate it, and it uses the sensors in it to figure out which way up you're holding it, and it will automatically change the orientation of the page. You can't actually, if you've got a page that is currently in with one of these pages, let's be specific, if you have one of these pages that supports both and it's currently displayed in portrait, you cannot encode, say, actually I want you to display it in landscape. So the only way it will switch is when the user does it. So
that's a bit like your program changing gravity.
Yeah,
so
indeed.
So your program can't say gravity now goes across because everyone would fall off the earth.
Yeah.
So basically what happens is you can't force that. You just say I can handle both, or I can handle one or the other.
Correct? Yeah, that's right.
Lovely.
However, just to complicate matters, if you've got a portrait, if you want a page that you always want to display in, let's say, landscape, you can just set the supported orientations property to just landscape, and it will always display in landscape, regardless of how the user is holding the phone. So effectively, you're forcing the user, if they're holding their phone in portrait, and then they switch to a page that you have set the supported orientations property to landscape only, you're forcing them to, it will display on end to them. They will be forced to turn it around in order to read it. But that might be appropriate for what you're trying to show them in the application.
From a game developer point of view, everything Andy said lines up completely with XNA. If you want to do an XNA game that can be played portrait or landscape, you can mark them as one or the other, or you can say I can do both and get events fired when the thing is tipped over, so your game knows they've changed the orientation of the phone. So the nice thing here is that what we're talking about applies to both Silverlight and XNA development.
Yep. So here we got line 4. This is where you tend to set the supported orientations. You can set it in code as well, of course. And there we've got a page here that is set to portrait or landscape. There's a couple of design tips, if you like, that which actually I'm going to show you in a demo. But that you have to be aware, if you're designing a form that's going to be displayed in both, tested in both, and some of the things you probably may end up using. One of the other container controls that we've not talked about yet. So you've seen the grid, and you've seen the stack panel. Another one is the scroll viewer. Uh-huh. Which is one of these, and here we've got an example there where the property in line 1 on the lower panel there, vertical scroll bar visibility is set to auto. It essentially means that if the content inside this scroll viewer extends beyond the visible display area, it will automatically stick a vertical scroll bar on for you so that the user can then scroll and see all the content.
So if we took our damage calc UI and lobbed it inside one of these and set the property, that would mean they could flip the screen, and even if we fell off the bottom, they could scroll back up again and find those buttons and controls.
Indeed. But bear in mind, that may be not a great user experience.
You don't like that, no, but it'll still work.
Indeed.
Bottom line, yeah.
Yeah. So I've got, here's an example of an orientation-aware form, and this is one I'm going to show you in a minute. So the content here, the title block stays in one place, but the content is scrollable. So you can scroll up and down here. We're going to show this one. I'm going to show the code first, and then you can show it in running on the real phone.
Okay.
Right. Content. Switch to my desktop again. I'm going to go and find my orientation sample.
So what this will do is display differently according to how I twizzle the phone.
Yep.
Lovely.
Yep. Let's get our main page up. So there you can see the, let's just shrink that down a bit. This form is supported orientations, portrait or landscape. And in the designer you can switch to landscape so you can see what it looks like. And you can see there it scrolls off the bottom. I don't think you can scroll it in that. You have to run it to and reset it. You can switch to portrait again back here. And inside the content, inside this, the content section, we've got at the moment we've got a stack panel. And if I run this just in the emulator first, we've got a stack panel. You can see that we've got a button at the top. We've got three interesting blue rectangles, which the use of this in this application is not clear. And then we've got a text block, and we've got a checkbox and a radio button. Now this app has a couple of problems, which is where you have to bring a few design skills in. So here we go in the emulator, and up here you can switch it round. So first of all, you have a look in the middle. You see that text? This is a text sample that wraps in portrait but does not in landscape. If we switch the orientation here in the emulator, well, we've got one problem, is that actually you can't scroll it. The stuff is off the bottom. The user has no way of getting at it. And in actual fact, the text doesn't wrap as well, although you can't see it, of course, because we can't scroll to it. But it's not wrapping as well. So,
this is pre-beta code.
Yeah. So the finished the solution here actually is to change this to a to actually change the content panel. Instead of a grid, we can actually change it to a scroll viewer. Change the closing tag as well. And we'll set that, vertical scroll bar visibility to be auto. Couple of other things that are a problem with this at the moment. Let's just run it with that. So that will allow us to scroll the stuff. Oh, right, okay. Well, the emulator doesn't like... Let's just try it. Now we're back in the... This is the normal portrait orientation. Oh, come on. Tell you what. Stop and restart. This is beta software, guys, so...
It works on the phone.
It does work very nicely on the phone, which we'll switch to in just a moment, because we can also show the auto thing. So there we've got... the portrait, and it's switched automatically to landscape, and actually we've got a scroll bar, which you can just see on the right there, but we've still got a problem in that the text sample that wraps in portrait but does not in landscape, that should be extending across the screen, so we can fix that as well. So the reason why that is because our text block here has got an explicit width set on it. So this is where the kind of things, if you just change that to auto, we will fix this. Now, do you want to show that application on the camera? So you switch the video. Now, there's another sample on the share that you can download, which is another way of handling orientation changes, mm-hmm. which is actually, that sample is interesting because it has some content that's set out in a grid, which has two columns. Okay. And in actual fact, the right-hand column in portrait orientation is empty, nothing in it. And then you can hook the on orientation changed event in the form and move the content from row 0, column 0, and actually move that stuff up to row 0, column 1. So you're physically moving the position within a grid of some content so that you're changing the layout completely, whether you're in portrait or landscape. So that's another way of handling. And that sample is called the orientation grid sample, which is on the share. You can download that. It's another very simple one, which illustrates a different technique. Right, so this lab is the one that we suggest you do to reinforce the messages that you've just been hearing. I saw your messages. I sound like advertising. Yeah.
Indeed, yes. Yep.
The lesson, the topics we've just been covering, the Windows Phone Navigation and Controls Lab in the training kit. If you go away and do that one, you'll be able to try these techniques for yourself. The navigation, it actually also has the application bar, and it has the orientation-aware stuff in it. So a lot of good exercise in there to really reinforce those messages.
Okay, and no time for a quiz, because I think we've actually hit the end stops.
We have.
So we'll be starting this afternoon at 1 o'clock our time. Your mileage may vary. That's in a couple of hours' time, guys. Is that right? Getting the nod from the man. Yeah, getting the smile. So that'll be games. Basically, we're doing the game stuff. That's what you've got coming next. So that to look forward to. Thank you very much for sticking around.
Yep.
We've got hundreds of people still there. You rock. You're wonderful. The game stuff, there'll be more jokes. I promise this. They won't be funny, but I'll call them jokes. But thank you very much for sticking around. And see you again after the lunch break. Thank you.
Thank you.